years that he put into the research and his fascination with the volcanoes from the time that we can count back and see photos in the 70s to all through his travels, to the time that you look at all the research and the digital files and the paper files. I mean, the clippings, they're all over the place. So this has a lot of history and a lot of passion. This makes me feel good that it is out there. And it would be selfish of me to hold this back to myself and just go, okay, that was great, and I'm going to keep it as a partial manuscript. No, this needed the voice and somebody who could compliment Michael so beautifully as Jim has done, and the two of them working together on this. I really say together as if Michael were still here, because as a person on the other side, I see this beautiful, you know, orchestration, this duet, if you will, of these two great authors coming together. So this has been an extraordinary experience and very joyful for me.
Well, Sherry Crichton and James Patterson, it has been such a pleasure talking to you both. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you very, very much.
The new novel by James Patterson and the late Michael Crichton is called Eruption.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR Today comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement designed by gastroenterologists to help relieve occasional bloating, gas, and abdominal discomfort. More at AlignProbiotics.com. And Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at ProgressiveCommercial.com. And the listeners, members, and sustaining members of KQED Public Radio. Global news and stories at 2 on the world. Right now, Julie Deppish returns with traffic starting in Orinda.
And we've got a three-vehicle crash here, eastbound 80 after Appian Way, closer to Pinole. They do have that far right lane blocked. Traffic really crawling back to San Pablo Dam Road. Little trouble in Vallejo, westbound 780 at Cedar Street. Got a two-car wreck, but not blocking. They're both on the right shoulder. Caltrain delays because of the fire near the tracks in Redwood City. Trains are transitioning to hourly service, so expect major delays for Caltrain. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from PG&D. 811 is a free service to keep the community safe. Before doing any digging, let PG&D mark gas and electric lines so they don't get hit. Call 811 before digging. More at pge.com/safety. Listener supported KQED FM San Francisco and KQEI FM North Highlands Sacramento. Also live online at kqed.org.
Mexico is getting its first woman president.
Que a mí me dice Andrés Manuel López Obrador, presidente.
Claudia Sheinbaum rejects the idea, though, that she's too close to the outgoing Mexican president. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Buehler. We'll hear from a Palestinian family that left Gaza seeking medical care for a young girl.
Alhamdulillah.
This family will never come back as before.
Plus, the thinking behind coming up with a heat action plan, landing on the far side of the moon, and in the Netherlands, the so-called offline club is trying to recreate things pre-mobile device.
I just want to get some hits of dopamine, and then it wears off, and then again, I want the same thing. It's just endless vicious cycle.
All those stories and more today on The World.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Israel says four more hostages taken by Hamas on October 7th are confirmed dead. This as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu faces pressure from the far-right members of his government to reject a peace plan that the White House says Israel proposed. White House National Security Advisor John Kirby is urging Hamas to take the deal.
Hamas absolutely needs to accept this proposal. It's a good one. It gets us 6 weeks apiece. It gets us hostages out. It gets us the ability to negotiate for phase two, which we get all the hostages out, and a potential cessation of hostilities.
G7 leaders are also calling on Hamas to accept it. They also reaffirm that they support a credible path to peace leading to a two-state solution. On Capitol Hill today, House Republicans spent hours grilling Dr. Anthony Fauci, former head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, on the origins of the COVID pandemic. NPR's Jeff Brumfield has more.
In more than 3 hours of testimony, House Republicans repeatedly asked Fauci about an NIH grant that had gone in part to a Chinese virology laboratory. A popular theory on the political right is that the SARS-CoV-2 virus was made in a Chinese lab with NIH money. While the NIH did fund virus work at the lab, Fauci refuted claims that the viruses studied led to the coronavirus.
It is molecularly impossible for those viruses to have evolved or being made into SARS-CoV-2.
Democratic lawmakers largely used the hearing to thank Fauci for his service and criticized the Republicans for what they say are baseless attacks on the retired 83-year-old researcher. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News, Washington.
The Atlantic hurricane season is here, and forecasters are predicting it will be one of the most active on record because of climate conditions and abnormally warm ocean temperatures. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports that has the Air Force's Weather Reconnaissance Unit, the Hurricane Hunters, bracing for a busy tropical season.
The 53rd Weather Reconnaissance Squadron is the only U.S. military unit tasked to collect real-time information for forecasters. They fly directly into the eyewall of dangerous storms. Colonel William McGee is the maintenance group commander who keeps the Hurricane Hunter fleet up and running at Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi, Mississippi.
I think of this as a combat mission. We are protecting our coastline from these storms.
The Hurricane Hunters track tropical systems in the Atlantic and Pacific, but also winter storms in the Northeast and atmospheric rivers on the West Coast. McGee says resources are stretched with increasing demand, yet the same number of planes and crew. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Wall Street ended the day in mixed territory, the Dow down 115 points, NASDAQ up 93. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. For the second time in recent weeks, the state's Public Employment Relations Board has denied a request from the University of California for an injunction against an ongoing strike by graduate students and other academic workers. UC maintains the strike is illegal. A statement from the union says, quote, "It's time for UC to face reality and negotiate with the union on issues relating to campus protests and free speech." Workers at three more UC campuses are now joining the strike over alleged unfair labor practices. UC San Diego and Santa Barbara today, and Irvine starting on Wednesday. UC Santa Cruz, Davis, and UCLA were already on strike. San Francisco city officials are backing a state bill that would give law enforcement more power to crack down on the sale of stolen goods on city streets. SB 925, which focuses most specifically on the Mission and the Tenderloin, would allow law enforcement to issue infraction and misdemeanor charges if vendors are found selling commonly stolen goods without permits. William Ortiz Cartagena, founder and treasurer of community organization CLEJA, says the proposed legislation would help protect legitimate street vendors.
We're community and we don't get down with fencing, but we will always support our culture, our history of street vending, and our community and our entrepreneurs that make San Francisco so dope.
The bill is sponsored by Mayor London Breed and Senator Scott Wiener, who say they're working with several groups representing street vendors. Find more news online at kqed.org. I'm Natalia Navarro.
There's a heat advisory that will kick into effect tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock around the Bay Area and run through midnight Thursday night. So needless to say, it's going to get hot tomorrow. Sunny skies, high temperatures ranging from the mid-60s at the coast to the upper 90s inland. Sacramento, you should see temperatures reaching triple digits. The time now is 2:06.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. Odoo is an all-in-one management platform designed to simplify and connect every aspect of your business operations through one efficient software. More information at odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us. In a big election year, two results this weekend stand out. We'll go to South Africa ahead this hour, but we start with Mexico's historic vote. For the first time, a woman will be president of Mexico.
Me convertiré
en la primera mujer presidenta de México.
And Mexico City's main plaza, Claudia Sheinbaum, said this victory is not only for her, but for all Mexican women and girls, including their female ancestors.
Sheinbaum won in a landslide over her nearest opponent, also a woman. The world's TV site Zay is in Mexico City, so you've spent recent days, TV, visiting polling stations, speaking with voters, going to campaign rallies. We know the result now, but describe what the scene has been heading into this election.
Yeah, so this was a historic election in many ways. First, because it was Mexico's largest election so far. Close to 20,000 politicians were elected yesterday. Second, this election was also very violent, with close to 30 political candidates killed so far this year, including one municipal candidate who was gunned down yesterday on election day. And last but not least, it put a woman into the presidency for the first time.
Right. And Sheinbaum wasn't the only woman elected to office. The results suggest that Mexico is emerging as one of the world's leaders in gender parity in politics, far outpacing the United States. How did this happen?
Well, there's a strong feminist movement in Mexico, which started pushing for more female representation. And finally, in 2019, the Mexican Congress approved a law mandating gender parity in government-appointed positions and also, you know, mandating that political parties present the same number of women and men candidates. And this has been very effective. After this election, Mexico will almost certainly have the fourth largest number of congresswomen in the world, and women governing nearly half of its 32 states. But as one voter told me yesterday, this doesn't necessarily mean better conditions for women in Mexico.
Porque las mujeres que están como candidatas están bajo el amparo de partidos políticos.
Because, she says, women are under the umbrella of political parties led by men.
Now, Claudia Sheinbaum has made very clear that her government will be a continuation of the one of current President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Remind us, TB, about his political platform.
Yeah, so his project represented a break from center-right parties that were in power for almost a century in Mexico. And the commitment was to support the working class, to support the poor, and it was supposed to end corruption, grow the Mexican economy, reduce violence. Some of this was accomplished and some of it was not, including violence and corruption, which many argue that became even worse. So now Sheinbaum is promising to follow his very same policies. And, you know, there are mixed opinions about those policies and many question whether Sheinbaum will be a different kind of leader.
Right. So, TB, you've been reporting on Claudia Sheinbaum's background. Tell us more about who she is and what that experience might mean for her presidency.
She's an environmental scientist with a PhD from UC Berkeley. She was the mayor of Mexico City and has 2 decades of experience in the public sector. And on top of that, she was part of a team that won a Nobel Prize. But she has a problem.
Pues no hay ninguna creatividad, si tú ves lo que dice.
There is no creativity in her message, says Luis Carlos Ugalde, a Mexican political scientist. According to him, she's always repeating what the president says. There is a perception that she's in the shadows of current President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Sheinbaum says that's not true.
Fíjense, está esta idea, ¿no?, de que yo no tengo personalidad.
There is this idea that I don't have a personality, she told reporters a few months ago, that President López Obrador tells me what to do. So then, she said, we can assume that he wrote my dissertation thesis for my degree on physics. She said she will be her own president. But she praises him every time she has a chance and never questions any of his policies. But what's going to happen when López Obrador is no longer there remains a big question. Sheinbaum's political career began in the year 2000 when López Obrador, who was the mayor of Mexico City at that time, invited her to a meeting at a diner.
Y ahí me dijo, yo lo que quiero es que disminuye la contaminación de la ciudad. ¿Sabes cómo hacer eso? Pues,
what I want is to reduce pollution, she recalled López Obrador telling her. Do you know how to do that? Sheinbaum, who was an expert on climate, said yes, and so she was named his Minister of Environment right after. During her tenure, she built bike lanes and boosted public transportation in Mexico City. But critics say she didn't push back against projects that were not environmentally friendly. In a documentary about her, she doesn't mention Obrador as her mentor. Instead, she mentions her parents.
Mis padres participaron en el movimiento estudiantil.
They participated actively in the student movement in 1968, she says, to protest tuition hikes, and that shaped her political ideology. Sheinbaum insists that she and Obrador are very different people. The president was raised in Mexico's countryside, doesn't speak English, and is not very interested in traveling abroad. Claudia Sheinbaum grew up among intellectuals, was educated in the U.S. where her daughter currently lives. She's not religious and rarely discusses her Jewish heritage. James Bosworth, a political risk analyst in Mexico City, says their personalities are in fact very different.
Claudia Sheinbaum is going to have a very difficult time maintaining the popularity that López Obrador has maintained. Because she is more of a technocrat and she's less of a populist.
People who have worked with her say she's very disciplined, strict, and hardworking. And those can be good qualities to get things done, Bosworth says. Sheinbaum has tried to explain why she's such a loyal follower of President Obrador. And the answer, she said in a recent interview, is conviction.
Things are changing for good in Mexico. And I think that we have to continue this transformation. We cannot go to the old governments that only did something for privileged people.
Sheinbaum will inherit a number of challenges. Violent crime is at a record high. The country's oil company is in debt. And drug cartels have strengthened their power. She will be sworn in September. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
The governor of New York has announced plans to ban smartphones in schools. In high schools in the Netherlands, they already are, but some Dutch people want to go further. Adults are now being encouraged to surrender their phones, at least for an evening. The venture is called the Offline Club. From Amsterdam, our Europe correspondent, Orla Berry, has more.
In the yoga studio, cum coffee shop, in the center of Amsterdam, Jordi van Bennekom is taking phones from everyone as they walk in the door.
This is the phone hotel, what we call it. We all keep them safe here.
The phone hotel is like a large locker with little dividers. Each phone fits neatly into its own separate slot. Salia Gunduz, a PhD student from Turkey, has just handed in her device. Gunduz reckons she spends at least 4 or 5 hours a day scrolling through her phone, mostly on Instagram or Reddit.
I just want to get some hits of dopamine and then it wears off and then again I want the same thing. It's just endless vicious cycle.
Gundu says her attention span has gotten really bad lately. It's affecting her studies, she says, and she blames it on the phone. Leah Davies from Wales is visiting Amsterdam for the weekend with her partner.
I just love the idea of it, really, of being able to go somewhere where you're not checking your phones. And
it's funny because most people would be thinking, coming to Amsterdam on a weekend holiday, they'll be in the coffee shops.
Yeah, well, we've got 4 nights, so this is one of them.
Jordi van Bennekom, one of the club's founders, lays out the rules for the evening.
Right now, we'll start with 45 minutes of time to yourself. So this is just whisper mode or doing your own thing. We'll have some nice music in the background, of course. After that, we'll have time to connect.
As everyone goes quiet, some people pull out books and start to read. Others have colouring books and start drawing. A few get tea at the cafe. After 10 minutes, I'm itching to check my phone. But then the temptation passes for about 10 minutes. After almost an hour, van Bennekom suggests we take a break from all the silence.
Right, guys. Almost an hour digital detox already.
nobody's having signs of remission from their phone. So now we'll have some time to connect, or you can just...
In the corner, three men are huddled together talking. They're from Puglia in Italy, they tell me. Two of them have come to Amsterdam to visit their friend Pietro Maggi, who lives here. Maggi says he thought it would be fun to try something different. Besides, they've done the usual Amsterdam stuff before, he says.
There's another reason why we did it. We know this guy is particularly addicted.
Maggi points his finger at his friend. His name is Damiano Caforio. Caforio says he doesn't think he has that much of a problem. He's already deleted all the social media apps from his phone. But as his two friends start laughing, he says,
I keep looking at news constantly in my life and what's going on in the world. But, you know, I need to be updated every moment of my life. And I need to control, let's say, the environment. That is why I'm addicted.
Even on the flight over here, Caforio says, he paid for Wi-Fi on board, just so he could text his friends while he was up in the air. Ilya Knepelhout, one of the three founders of the offline club, tells me later that the reason they set up the venture was that each of them had started to feel that their phones were dominating their lives.
I didn't have the chance or the time to do some things that I really value, like reading a book, journaling, or just slowing down for once.
The club launched officially in February this year. Knepelhout posted about it on Instagram, and the videos went viral.
We received messages from across the world, from Brazil, from the US, from Australia. They're asking, when are we coming there? But we do see the irony.
An offline club that goes viral wasn't exactly the intention, he says. One day, they'd like to expand to other countries, but they do it slowly, he says. Back at the offline club, the three Italians say they already feel a little different, kind of relaxed, a little more grounded. Then they start reminiscing about the days before smartphones, back when they were teenagers. Remember, Damiano Caforio says, back then every phone call cost money.
The phone plans were expensive. Like when we were 16, we used to ring. You're a girl, I'm thinking of you. If you ring twice, I'm thinking of you.
They had a code, he says. If you liked a girl, you'd ring her number a few times and then hang up, just to let her know you were thinking about her. And if she left several missed calls on your phone, well, he says, there was no feeling in the world quite like it. For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Amsterdam.
South African voters sent a clear message to the party that's been in power since the end of apartheid, why the ANC lost its majority. Just ahead, you're listening to The World.
You're listening to The World on KQED Public Radio. Good afternoon, I'm Sandy Althaus. We're going to check in again with Julie Depesch. It looks like better news in Pinole for Pinole drivers. Hey, Julie.
Sandy, yes, it is better news. They've cleared that three-vehicle crash. It was eastbound 80 after Appian Way was blocking a lane for a while. Still recovering the backup to McDonald. A new problem in Hayward, south 880 before A Street. Pickup truck and a car got into it. They're in the left lane. And we've got a crash in San Jose in southbound 880. This is before the Alameda. A couple cars out of the lanes on the right shoulder. Julie Depesch for KQED.
Thanks, Julie. Make this summer unforgettable with KQED's summer guides. From thrilling concerts to captivating art shows, we've got your guide to all the must-see events. Explore more at kqed.org/summerguide2024. This is KQED Public Radio.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. In South Africa, the results of last week's national elections were announced over the weekend, and for the first time in three decades, the African National Congress, the party of Nelson Mandela, has lost its absolute majority.
Since the end of apartheid in the 1990s, the ANC has been mired by corruption scandals and a failure to deliver widespread economic prosperity to South Africans. The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gakandi, reports on what comes next.
20 years ago, the African National Congress easily won elections with 70% of the vote. This time around, that support has plunged to 40%. While that still makes the ANC the leading party in parliament, it's not enough for them to be able to solely determine the next president. ANC leader and South Africa's current president, Cyril Ramaphosa, acknowledged that fact with some humor when the election results were officially announced on Sunday.
Instead of saying distinguished, you said extinguished. I'm not yet extinguished.
The election results speak to the widespread dissatisfaction with the ANC's decades-long leadership, which has been plagued by economic mismanagement, corruption scandals, and infrastructure problems. 28-year-old Sekile Matokoza spoke about that from a polling station.
Our country is never going to be rescued if we continue to have ANC in government, because they are manufacturing poverty and they have no solution. Instead, the only solution they have is to enrich themselves only.
That the ANC and the president have gracefully accepted their loss is a sign of the strength of South Africa's democracy, says William Gumede, governance professor at Witwatersrand University.
Because normally in Africa, governing parties don't do that. They will contest and they will fight. So it's a good thing. Yeah, it's an important statement from President Ramaphosa to accept the outcome and to now begin to look for partnerships for coalitions.
What comes next will determine Ramaphosa's political future. More than a dozen political parties have won seats in the National Assembly, which is the parliamentary body that will vote for South Africa's president in the next 14 days. The successful presidential candidate will need to win more than 50% of that vote. Ramaphosa urged politicians to find common ground.
What this election has made plain is that the people of South Africa expect their leaders to work together to meet their needs.
There are different ways a coalition could go. A new populist party led by former ANC leader and president Jacob Zuma, who resigned amid corruption scandals, has said they are willing to join together with the ANC on the condition that Ramaphosa is no longer the president. Other parties are looking to build coalitions along moderate values, rejecting populist calls to deport illegal immigrants and seize land from white farmers. John Steenhuisen, the leader of the Democratic Alliance, which won the second highest number of votes, said they are looking for collaborators to
create 2 million new jobs, to halve the rate of violent crime, lift 6 million people out of poverty, triple the number of grade 4 learners who can read for meaning, and ensure quality health care.
Regardless of the outcome over the next few days, governance professor William Gomede says this election has put a healthy check on the power of the long-standing ruling party and forced them to acknowledge their failings in recent decades.
They're beginning to take accountability in a way they've never, ever done the last 30 years. That is already a change in our public discourse.
It's also proven that voting can make a difference. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi.
A scorching heat wave in India is breaking records as temperatures top 120 degrees Fahrenheit in places. As a result, 56 people have died, including election officials overseeing polls in the world's largest democracy. Around 25,000 cases of heat-related illness have been recorded. India, like other countries with extreme highs, is working to keep people safe with heat action plans. Vijay Lamaye is the director of Applied Research Initiatives at the Natural Resources Defense Council and has worked on this problem.
A heat action plan is basically an organizing framework for states and cities in India, but really beyond that too, to get ahead of the heat problem. We know that climate change is fueling longer, more frequent, and more intense heat waves in India, in South Asia, and really around the world. So heat action plans are all about an effort to basically recognize heat as a severe health threat. Sometimes it goes kind of underappreciated. People take it for granted that they can just turn on the AC or escape the heat in the shade. But we know, as you said, that heat can really cause life-threatening health complications.
What are some of the things that are shown to have worked on keeping people safe during heat waves? You mentioned the healthcare sector. I imagine there's infrastructure issues also.
Definitely. Here we're talking really about, you know, a menu of short, medium, and long-term actions that cities and states can take to reduce the threat, right? So we're talking about first just building public awareness and taking care of community outreach to make sure that people are aware that heat is a life or death issue and they don't treat it too casually. We also know that there's a need to connect data and forecasting, you know, understanding what the climate modelers are telling us in terms of when extreme heat may be headed to a particular region, and making sure that people in that region are aware of it ahead of time so that they can take preventive actions. You know, think about modifying school hours, changing traffic patterns even, so that traffic police in India aren't exposed, you know, all day in the hot sun. Also thinking about how to improve training of healthcare professionals. Sometimes heat-related illness looks like something else when folks show up in the emergency room. If those healthcare professionals are better trained to understand what heat-related illness looks like, they can help to implement, you know, stronger corrective action once those folks arrive in their healthcare settings.
What parts of India have you worked on with these heat action plans, and are they any of the places that are experiencing these extreme temperatures right now?
More than a decade ago, we helped to launch India and South Asia's first heat action plan in the city in the northwest called Ahmedabad in the state of Gujarat. And the early evidence indicates that Ahmedabad's heat action plan, a city that's faced terrible heat for a long time, is helping to avoid more than 1,100 deaths each year since it was first launched in 2013. Since that year, the plan's approach has thankfully blossomed across the country. It's now clear that many heat-prone states and cities, you know, dozens of states and probably 100 cities or so, have their own heat action plans.
In India, who tends to be the most vulnerable to extreme heat, and how is their vulnerability being addressed?
Many of these heat plans right now do not really have good insight into where vulnerable populations are and how to address those populations. We know that in a country like India, maybe about 10% of households actually right now have access to air conditioning, especially folks who are living in urban slums, right? You can imagine just the concentration of heat. Oftentimes these areas are basically paved over, lots of, you know, metal and concrete. Those are materials that help to absorb and really magnify the heat problem, especially in India's cities. We're also looking at outdoor workers. You know, India's agricultural sector is beginning to suffer measurably from climate change. We know that it's harming agricultural yields, but it's also harming the workers who help to deliver those yields, right? So we need to think about creative ways to deploy, you know, cooling centers and urban greening and shade, water breaks for workers. It's really a whole mindset shift to enable people to thrive in the face of an intensifying climate problem.
Vijay Lamaye is the Director of Applied Research Initiatives at the Natural Resources Defense Council. More global news and stories are still ahead this hour. You're listening to The World.
Support for KQED comes from Sutter Health. From 34 joint replacement centers to 5 cardiovascular surgery centers, Sutter never stops helping patients get back on their feet. Learn more at sutterhealth.org. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Donating a car to KQED is easy. We'll arrange to have it picked up, running or not in most cases, then invest the funds back into our news coverage. You can learn more at kqed.org/cars. The time is 2:30.
A musician from Somalia fled the civil war there in the early 90s. He was a teenager.
I continued playing songs and becoming a peace activist through the music. I become so vocal.
That meant speaking up when people said his music was un-Islamic. That story still ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Progressive Insurance, with the Name Your Price tool, offering a range of coverage and price options to choose from. Now that's Progressive. More at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, they'll publish family memories into a bound book to keep forever. Learn more at StoryWorth.com.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. After nearly 8 months of war in the Gaza Strip, Israel's prime minister says his military's objectives remain unchanged. Benjamin Netanyahu over the weekend said he would not agree to a permanent ceasefire until Hamas is defeated and the remaining hostages are released.
This followed an announcement from Joe Biden, who proposed a ceasefire plan late last week. The Israeli military campaign has killed more than 36,000 Palestinians since last October, according to the Hamas-controlled health ministry. UNICEF says an estimated 17,000 children have been orphaned or separated from their parents, and at least 3,000 Palestinian children have had one of their limbs amputated.
The world's Dury Buscarin traveled to Qatar to meet with families evacuated from Gaza for medical treatment. Today we'll meet Mariam. And a warning, this report contains graphic descriptions of war.
This is a story a six-year-old should never have to tell. Mariam Farjalla has curly brown hair, a white lace party dress, and when she stands to greet you, it's with perfect balance. So it takes a moment before you realize she's missing her right leg. Mariam sits down with her aunt, Fatima Farjalla. When Mariam's parents and little brother were killed in an Israeli bombing in January, 19-year-old Farjalla became her caregiver.
This family will never come back as before.
That's Palestinian journalist Amira Haruda, translating for Farjalla. Farjalla tells us the whole family lived in Nuseirat, near the beach in central Gaza. When the war began to draw closer, they decided to go to a displacement camp in Rafah together.
They were looking for like different materials so they can build their own tent. Stones, wood, nylon, plastic, anything that they can use it as a shelter.
One day, Farjalla says, a relative was shot in the hand while she was cooking food for her children. Her kids were killed in front of her. That's when her sister, Reem, decided she didn't want to move anymore.
She said that, okay, let's go back to our home. They will bomb here and there, and let's die in our dignity.
The entire extended family gathered in her mother's home in central Gaza. Farjalla remembers listening to this song, Mariam Mariamti, while they laughed together, sharing memories. Mariam, the oldest grandchild, adored her little brother and her younger cousins. For one night, Farjalla says, it felt like there was no war. You never know for sure when an airstrike is coming, but there are signs. This is sound from YouTube of an Israeli drone. On January 9th, Farjalla says, the family counted 16 of them in the sky above their home. When the bombing started, the family sheltered in two rooms. Fatima Farjalla's sister picked up her baby and sat down to breastfeed. Her brother went into the kitchen to make tea. The house was hit with two blasts. The first threw Farjalla out of the room. When she regained consciousness, she ran back to her family.
A wall full of blood, pieces of meat, shrapnels everywhere, and I couldn't recognize who's alive and who's dead.
Knowing another blast could come at any moment, the survivors struggled to identify who was alive. Farjalla found her nephew's body so mutilated she couldn't recognize him. Her 27-year-old sister Wafa was dead, her body curled around her baby boy. In the middle of the madness, Farjalla couldn't find Mariam until she cried out for help.
There is a lot of bleeding from her ear, from her nose, and she was covered with blood, and there is like the skin is like, you know, gone, and there is like a smell of burn, like something is burning.
Mariam remembers that awful drive to the hospital, crammed into her uncle's car. She remembers being shuttled between hospitals and stuck with needles. With no anesthesia available at the hospital, doctors had to amputate her leg while she was still awake. What Mariam doesn't know is that doctors told her family they didn't think she would survive.
Blood in her chest, and there is a lot of bleeding all over her body. From the doctor, he said that don't hurry to bury the leg. Just wait, because you will bury her with the leg soon.
I reached out to the Israeli military and asked for the reason for this specific strike. Was it an accident or intentional? In a statement, a spokesperson wrote, "The Israeli Defense Forces is operating to dismantle Hamas military and administrative capabilities, In stark contrast to Hamas's intentional attacks on Israeli men, women, and children, the IDF follows international law and takes feasible precautions to mitigate civilian harm. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, 126 people were killed that day. Among them were Farajala's two older sisters and three of their children. What hurts the most, Fatima Farajala says, is remembering how hard it was for her sisters to have kids at all, the years they spent going through fertility treatments.
At the end, when you are waiting this child and waiting, then you have him and you make all the small details for him and for his life. Then with one rocket from the army, they just took the life. They don't care how we suffered to have these children, and they just took the life of the children.
Farajala says her six-year-old niece Mariam is all she has left of her sister. And after the amputation, to truly save Mariam's life, she would have to get her through the Rafah border crossing into Egypt and on to Qatar for medical treatment. But making it there was never a guarantee. For The World, I'm Derry Biscarin.
Tomorrow, we'll hear more about what it takes for Palestinians in need of medical care to get out of the Gaza Strip.
The dark side of the moon, the one that faces away from planet Earth, remains mostly unexplored. Over the weekend, the China National Space Administration landed a spacecraft on the far side of the moon to collect soil and rock samples. The mission could reveal differences between this less explored far side of the moon and the better known near side. It also helps us imagine how deeper knowledge of our moon can help advance other missions in space exploration. For more, we reached out to Renu Malhotra. She's an astronomer at the University of Arizona.
It's very exciting. The big part of it is that they plan to bring samples back from that side. Incidentally, I would call it the far side rather than the dark side. It's not always dark. The moon has a day-night cycle, which is almost a month, and all parts of the moon get sunlight. It's dark to us in the sense that it faces away from us, and so it's dark in the sense that we have less information about it historically than we have of the front side, the near side, as we call it.
Yeah, so let me just quickly ask you, do we ever see that far side of the moon? Does it ever rotate so that, you know, we here on planet Earth do see it half the time?
No, we don't see all of it. We see a tiny bit of it because the moon presents one hemisphere, and that hemisphere slightly wobbles. So we get to see a little bit, just a tiny little bit of the other side as it wobbles and presents a slightly different hemisphere as it wobbles around this main near-side hemisphere.
You expressed your excitement earlier over the samples that will be collected from the far side of the moon. What difference can you expect to see with those samples from other samples that we already have?
The far side of the moon is thought to be geologically the most ancient. You know, the moon records history of impacts, say impact craters, throughout its history, throughout the Earth's history even, whereas the Earth's impact history has been wiped out, and its formation history also has been mostly wiped out due to its geological activity. On the moon, a lot of that is preserved. On the near side, some of it has been wiped out and some of it is still there on the parts that don't have these large-scale lava flows.
I got to say, Renu, it's surprising to me that we have all this data about deep space, but this closer body, our moon, these are still mysteries.
Indeed, you could say that, yes. There are a lot of mysteries about the moon. The moon is a very, very interesting object, astronomically, geologically, you know, for many, many other reasons. It affects life on Earth, and we have a lot of mysteries about it still unsolved.
In terms of China itself and the science, what are they setting out to accomplish with this mission?
As a scientist, I would say, you know, I think all the mysteries that we have about the Earth's moon system, our planet's history, is, of course, very motivating for a scientist. There are other sociological reasons, I suspect, that motivates any kind of space program like this that's done ostensibly for science, but it's also about establishing technological dominance or prominence, demonstrating technology and engineering prowess.
What excites you about these particular efforts regarding the moon than what we've seen before on the moon and other missions?
You know, anytime humankind looks on the other side of the hill, so to speak, we find new things. We find new challenges, new opportunities. So if we can make this more routine, cheaper, and a lot of that actually has been happening here, right here in the U.S. So if we can keep pushing that, you know, that challenge, if we can keep improving on that and meeting that challenge and getting to space even cheaper, I think that would open up new ways, new things that we haven't imagined yet. That's exciting to me.
Renu Malhotra is an astronomer at the University of Arizona.
Roughly half of the seafood consumed worldwide is produced through aquaculture, also known as fish farming. The industry depends on a tiny creature called brine shrimp, whose natural habitat is under threat. That's the focus today of our Climate Solutions Reporting Project, The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Muinak in Uzbekistan is the site of some environmental degradation that's very much tied up with aquaculture, as we hear in this report from Levi Bridges in Uzbekistan.
I'm standing by a lighthouse overlooking a vast desert with rusty ships marooned in the sand. Locals call this place the Ship Cemetery. Back in the 60s, Muinak was on the shore of a massive lake called the Aral Sea. But the water was diverted to agriculture, which shrunk the lake dramatically. And that, in turn, destroyed the fishing industry, which was the town's lifeblood.
I wasn't expecting to feel so affected by this place. But seeing these big ships just abandoned and rusting in the desert, it really just does drive home what a huge catastrophe this was.
As the lake became smaller, it turned salty, killing off all the fish. Local fisherman Mirbek Mirzamuratov watched the lake dry up as a kid. He says, I went to a summer camp on the lake, but they tore down the buildings after the water disappeared. As kids, we didn't think much about it, he says. Everyone just assumed the water would come back. Part of the Aral Sea is in Kazakhstan, where a dam was built to revive one part of the lake. Here on the other side of the border in Uzbekistan, though, officials didn't make strong conservation efforts. But the inaction actually made something pretty amazing happen. Brine shrimp, which were likely carried here by migrating birds, proliferated in Uzbekistan's now salty water. Fishermen like Mirzamuratov went back to work gathering brine shrimp eggs. A half day's drive from Muinak, on the Aral Sea's new shoreline, Mirzamuratov draws a long net through the water to gather the tiny eggs. They look almost exactly like grains of sand. These eggs, also known as cysts, get shipped around the world and used as feed for fish and prawns. Their size and durability is part of what makes them so valuable, says Tim Hawks, a lawyer working with the brine shrimp industry.
Those cysts are almost indestructible. So you can boil them, you can freeze them, you can send them to outer space, and still, under the right conditions, they're going to hatch out.
You might have seen brine shrimp for sale at your local pet store, sold under their more common name, sea monkeys. Patrick Sorgeloos is a professor of aquaculture in Belgium. He says the eggs were first used to feed fish in a public aquarium in San Francisco. Producers in Japan started using them in aquaculture. The practice quickly spread.
Modern aquaculture really exploded from marginal productions because companies were able to have easy access with brine shrimp.
Farm-raised seafood now relies so heavily on these little eggs that if you've ever eaten shrimp at a cocktail party, then you have likely taken part in the sea monkey food chain yourself.
All the shrimp that you eat in the United States have received brine shrimp without any exaggeration. All.
But brine shrimp have a new vulnerability, one that threatens to jeopardize how we feed the planet. Salt lakes they live in are disappearing because of climate change and overuse of water. At a seasonal encampment on the Aral Sea, Uzbek workers spend months gathering brine shrimp eggs. inside a cabin covered in sheets of plastic to keep out the rain, Islam Tenilov says the lake is getting lower each year. He says he worries everybody here will lose their jobs and have to go work in Russia, because if the water gets much lower, then it will become too salty, even for brine shrimp. Scientists believe that will happen in the next decade, so they're searching for a way to save the industry. In the Uzbek city of Nukus, I visit a lab where biologist Abladin Musayev runs experiments in a tank full of little pink brine shrimp squiggling in the water.
Wow, they're so cool.
He's researching how to farm them here in small ponds. The initial results are really promising. Musayev says farming brine shrimp isn't rocket science. Unlike traditional aquaculture for fish, you don't need high-tech equipment. You don't even need a lot of water. Brine shrimp farming operations are already up and running in Vietnam and Iran. They're scaling up production to prepare for a future where more salt lakes might disappear. Scientists believe Uzbekistan can be part of the solution because the dried up Aral Sea has left behind abundant natural salts in the soil, which brine shrimp love. So a huge environmental disaster in a barren desert can actually help feed the world's growing population, which makes places like that ship cemetery feel a little less depressing. As I wander around the halls of the ships back at the cemetery, school kids run toward me and burst into song.
When I first came to the ship's cemetery, it seemed so desolate and sad, but now it is just teeming with life. It's kind of a metaphor for the lake itself, that even when something dies, something else comes alive.
For the world, Levi Bridges, Muynak, Uzbekistan.
Music is the strong thread that ties one man in Maine to his childhood roots in Somalia. His story is just ahead. You're listening to The World.
Support for KQED comes from UCSF Health, collaborating with Marin Health to deliver exceptional orthopedic care in the North Bay. Leading specialists in arthritis, joint replacement, spine, hand, elbow, and more. UCSFHealth.org/MarinHealth. Canyon Ranch Woodside, inviting guests to find their path to well-being at its retreat in the Redwoods, minutes south of San Francisco. Weekend packages available. Visit CanyonRanch.com for more info.
The mortgage interest deduction is helping some buyers afford their homes, but there are some trade-offs in this high interest rate environment we shall discuss next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace coming up this afternoon at 4, and you can hear it again tonight at 6:30 on KQED Public Radio.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Hadith Abdulli is a musician living in Maine, but he grew up in Somalia during the Civil War that started in the early 1990s. At the time, Abdulli was just a kid. He sings and taught himself to play the oud, an instrument similar to a lute. Abdulli thinks of music as a kind of home he carries with him. From Lewiston, Maine, Caroline Losnick brings us his story.
I think I am a musician by birth. That's the only way I can say. I was born with it.
That's Hadith Abdulli, a Somali musician.
I play some music for fun, for my personal pleasure, and that's how I connect to people, and I enjoy it.
He plays an oud, a pear-shaped instrument a little like a guitar, but without frets. Oud means from wood in Arabic, and it's not super common in Maine, where Abdulli lives and performs.
But it's the grandfather of all instruments.
For Abdulli, it goes beyond playing in front of audiences.
In the midnight, sometimes I wake up and then I just play it. And I feel like a remedy when I'm touching it. And I try always to guide my emotions into this music spiritually. It's part of my personality, I guess.
He loved going to school, but not for what he was learning in the classroom.
Because the wise man of this school plays the oud. So I was going to school just to see that guy playing the oud.
But he had another influence, too. He calls his older sister Sarah his musical second mother. His actual mom didn't want him to make music. She thought it was a bad influence. But Sarah looked after him while their mom worked in a nearby sugar mill, and she'd listen to Radio Mogadishu and sing along with it. He begged Sarah to teach him to sing, too. If she asked him to run errands, he'd agree, but only if she'd teach him a song.
Yeah, songs like that.
He remembers this part of his early childhood in Somalia being really happy.
Most of the thing I remember is the Eid celebration of Muslims. I remember guys drumming, people sharing food. I remember my father taking us to the beach, watching the waves of the sea, the ocean. I remember those good things.
But then his dad, a poet, was arrested.
Because he was saying something against the government in his poetry.
At the time, suppression of government dissent was on the rise in Somalia. Abdulli remembers ambulances, gunshots, and looting in his neighborhood. Then, in 1991, things got worse.
I was 5 years old when the government collapsed, and things became horrible. Clan clashes started, and catastrophic things happened. I lost my young sister because of starvation.
This is generally considered the tipping point for Somalia entering a period of civil war. American troops arrived, and Abdulli and his family hoped that peace and food would follow. But as a little boy, what stood out was Humvees everywhere.
Now when I see America Humvees, I get two feelings, scary. And the other feeling is that sometimes they throw some food for us. Two different emotions. Like, those guys, do they gonna kill you or do they gonna give you a food?
He wrote a song called Somalai about witnessing people being killed by terrorist explosions. The title means, Hey, Somalis.
Like, hey, Somalis. Like, come on, Somalis. Like, emotional song. Yeah, it says that, you know, Somalia, Melarakta, Somalis. Do you see, I see Somali mother crying. I mean, every day there's an explosion that happens in the heart of the Mogadishu, claims innocent civilians. And it's not a normal thing. Are we normalized those things to happen, like, in our daily life, every day?
As a teenager, with things so unstable, Abdulli moved around a lot. He spent time in Kenya, in Nairobi, but also in a large refugee camp where he played with other musicians. He refused to join militias or become radicalized.
I continued playing songs and becoming a peace activist through the music. I become so vocal, and that's when I become quite threatened.
Threatened, he says, by people who called his music un-Islamic, although Abdulli disagrees.
It's not an Islamic thing. It's like peace is much needed in this country, and we have to say more about this. This wide world, the problem is us. I mean, it's enough, all of us. This song is for peace.
In 2016, Abdulli arrived in the U.S. as a refugee.
I come with my oud, a jacket, yeah, not too much stuff.
One of the very few people he knew, and not really, was a fiddler and elementary school orchestra teacher in Maine, Greg Boardman, who'd once left a comment on Abdulli's SoundCloud page.
And I opened it up. And he says, I love your music, so if you ever come to America, please contact me. I was like, okay.
But he didn't forget it, and Abdulli eventually did reach out. The two musicians got together and recorded 8 songs. It was the beginning of a lasting friendship, and it opened up new opportunities to make music. Abdulli's now lived in Lewiston, Maine for 8 years. It's the whitest state in the country, and Lewiston has had a complicated relationship with its refugee community. In 2002, the city's mayor wrote an open letter to Somali leaders suggesting they discourage friends and family from relocating there. Things have come a long way since then, but Abdulli says things aren't always easy. He's experienced racism and feels tokenized at a community college he attends.
Sometimes you feel like pushed away, pushed back.
He's worked hard to make Maine his home.
I become citizen in Lewiston, Maine.
Recently, he was asked to lead a program for young people at the Center for Grieving Children, where he played his oud and shared his music.
And you know, American kids are very inquisitive. They ask me, like, oh, how many strings this instrument has? When do you start playing it? Are you bald? Do you have hair on your head? Gradually, I explained the way I was grieving through music. When I was young, I didn't get resources except just to fix myself through the music. When I finished the program, they give me a hug, and I become very emotional.
And in Maine, Abdulli's music finds Somali and Somali-American audiences who connect with his lyrics and message.
But life can't take you everywhere in this world. And wherever you go and place that you find peace is home. I don't know how to say this, but without music, I don't know how my life will be like.
For the World, I'm Caroline Losnick in Maine.
The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the philanthropic foundation Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the United States Japan Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Amy Rao and Harry Plant, Roman Mars, Dan Kletter, Ashton Peary and Catherine Wolfe, Beverly and Don Freeman, and Carolyn Telcott. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.